Hi, this is Nick Rude from the Michigan Wolverines, and this is the D-Fly and Dixie podcast.
To the D-Fly and Dixie podcast, brought to you by our presenting partner, Simplicity Group, and featuring Big Ten Network, ESPN, Inside Lacrosse Analysts, and my old friend, Mark Dixon. I am your host, Dan Flynn. Dix, this is our annual episode that drops on Thursday as the conference tournament semifinals get underway across the nation. Lots of lacrosse to talk about. And we'll sit down with Michigan's leading scorer, Nick Rude, for a fun interview as he talks about the Wolverines while they get ready for the Big Ten semifinals. And we'll cover all the big games this weekend. So, Dixie, let's get it. Dixie, the postseason is upon us. This is the most exciting time of the year.
It really is. How about that? Feels like yesterday we were complaining about frigid temperatures and freezing and games being canceled and postponed. And now we're here in tournament weekend, or tournament week, really. We're recording this on a Tuesday night. Just watched Lehigh knock off BU in the Patriot League quarterfinals. Bucknell and Colgate are now tangling to see who will play Loyola, as Lehigh will get Army as the lowest remaining seed in the Patriot League tournament. But yeah, a lot of things to figure out, a lot of things to look forward to, and it's going to be a great week.
Let's bring in our guest, the editor in chief of Inside Lacrosse, and our old buddy Matt Kinnear. Matt, welcome back to the show.
Awesome. Thanks for having me. Mark, Echo, it's an awesome week. You know, it's up there with the NCAA tournament in terms of like it's do or die. You get to see like the teams from, you know, the conferences that only have an AQ path, you know, the kind of like drama and excitement that you get there. This Thursday through Sunday is kind of one of the all-time stretches of the season.
It really is. And before we move on and talk about all the amazing games coming up, like, it always hits me on the Sunday of this past weekend when there's half the college team's season ended. Their seasons are over. And we were, as Dixie said, we're sort of like just kind of starting to talk about them. And it felt like, I mean, I know it was probably just a few weeks ago, but like we're really in the conference play. And then boom, it's over. It's just over for a lot of teams. And it's not even May yet.
Think about the women's game. I was down at Duke doing North Carolina Duke on ACC Network on April 16th. And that was for that day was the last regular season day for a few of the women's teams in the ACC. So at least in the men's side, they got, you know, another week together, if you will. But yeah, it's if you didn't make your conference tournament and you are not a member of the ACC, then yeah, your season is over.
Wow. Well, a reminder, the D-Fly and Dixie podcast is brought to you by our presenting partner, Simplicity Group. Simplicity Group is a leading financial products distribution firm that specializes in providing best-in-class insurance, investment, and business development solutions. To learn more, visit simplicitygroup.com. Now, on to the games. Matt, you know, most of the people in the lacrosse world use Inside Lacrosse as their season-long guide for following college lacrosse, and that's what we're going to do here. You wrote an excellent article on Tuesday of this week that talks about the varying levels of excitement, concern for each of the conference tournaments. I'm hoping you'll bring some of that to this discussion, but we're going to start with a alphabetical. I think this is the way to frame this weekend, is we'll go alphabetically through the different conference tournaments, talk about what's expected, who the favorite team is, and get your Dixie's perspective on each of those conference tournament races. And we'll start alphabetically in the ACC. These games are on Friday, semifinals. It's been being hosted in Charlotte, North Carolina. On Friday, the first semifinal is the top seed Notre Dame Fighting Irish versus number 4 Virginia. It's at 5:00 on the ACC Network. The nightcap features number 2 seed North Carolina versus number 3 seed Syracuse at 8. Dixie, how do you see these games breaking down? Should we start with just Let's start with that Notre Dame Virginia game.
Rematch of a game in Charlottesville where Virginia got their, well, Lars Tiffany said they got their season back on track after they lost in overtime to Maryland. But really, this is the game that let the lacrosse world know that they were back on the right track, beating Notre Dame at Klockner. Be a great matchup. Notre Dame likes to keep it low scoring, likes to have long possessions. Virginia loves to run and gun. You know, really, their top four are as good maybe as anybody in the country when you think about the Millen brothers, Colsey, Truett Sunderland. Brendan Millen is just phenomenal as a freshman. And I think that since Kevin Cassis has given him the keys to the offense, Virginia's been a much, much different team. Doesn't turn the ball over as much as his brother and doesn't demand the ball on his stick as much as McCabe does. But Notre Dame's not going to be an easy out for sure. They're the number one seed, and they've rebounded from that loss to, you know, smack teams around over the last few weeks. So, you know, Sean Light, co-ACC Defensive Player of the Year, Richard Deli, Goalie of the Year. I think that just kind of shows you what Notre Dame's backbone is. You know, it's on the defensive side of the field. So, you know, you've got your high-octane offense against one of the nation's, if not the nation's, best defense. Second semifinal, North Carolina-Syracuse, a game that Carolina won a few weeks back in Chapel Hill in convincing fashion, held Joey Spallina to double donuts. Why even play this game, right? Because North Carolina can only win at Dorrance with a home field advantage on grass, and Syracuse can only win in a dome, right? The North Carolina home field advantage on Dorrance because of grass is one of the dumbest things I've heard in a long time. They're good this year. They have a really good team. They've been playing on Dorrance for a number of years when they haven't had really, really good seasons. So how it's become a home field advantage all of a sudden in 2026 is beyond me. But Syracuse is a defense that slides, and Carolina has success against sliding defenses throughout the season. And then hovering over this in the clouds or wherever is, you know, a couple hours away in Durham. Duke has a pulse by virtue of their win over North Carolina last week. I think it would be, man, to play a schedule like that and to win in the metric category. But, you know, you have other, I don't know, man, for them to still have an opportunity to make the tournament. Hey, it's great, you know, but one win jumps you, what, 10, 11, 12 spots in the RPI? I don't know. But this will be a fun weekend. It always is. You get these teams together. No AQ. They'll just beat the hell out of each other. And we'll see who hoists the trophy around 2, 2:30 on Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, it's such a weird, like, it's such a weird thing, right? It's going to be like some of the best lacrosse we'll see all year. You know, these four teams, you know, they hate each other. They're the best teams in the country. You've got these like kind of subplots within it. You know, you've got the like, is it going to be like, you know, like a Sean Light matching up with someone who is like to Wharton Canada on the other end? You already mentioned the Millen brothers and like what they've done. There's so many like subplots that just don't revolve around the AQ, you know, the AQ, the RPI, et cetera, except for the one team that's not even there, and that's Duke. And they're just going to be kind of, they're the most interesting team that is in the ACC right now, and they're not even playing. So for that, it's all kind of interesting. One of the things that I was writing about this week is I do think this might shape the Wharton race in a pretty significant way. Joey Spallina is the offensive player of the year in the ACC. Owen Duffy certainly has a huge case, you know, to have that award as well. And Sean Light is kind of the guy that's looming over the whole Wharton picture. You know, say, like, Notre Dame just strangles this weekend and, you know, wins a game 8-6 and wins a game 10-7. That's got to put him in the driver's seat for the Wharton Award. And I would love to see a defensive player, particularly in a year where it's not like full of alpha offensive guys. I think Sean Light really makes some sense there. So this is going to be a lot of fun. Like, this is like one of those things that, like, you turn on the ACC tournament, you don't really need to care who wins in the sense of like, oh my God, if my team loses, we're out of it. You can just enjoy the ride. Like, just kind of like grab a few beers and just buckle up and just watch lacrosse. It's awesome.
What about Brady Wambach maybe establishing a little bit of a case for Wharton?
Yeah, I mean,
I know that's unprecedented as well as a defender, a faceoff man, but he was with Sean Light, co-defensive player of the year in the ACC.
Yeah, and it's like it's tough to – I'd love to crunch the numbers of like how teams do in the ACC tournament and then how they like end up doing in the NCAA tournament. So it's kind of like you can just kind of go all out, see what happens, learn from it, and adjust. Plus you're playing these games that are just tremendous RPI boosts for your team anyway. It's just a fun weekend. Like really just like let's not overthink this one too much. Let's just have some fun.
All right. Well, I'm going to overthink it for a second. How much is Duke's fate tied to the success of North Carolina in this weekend? For instance, if North Carolina wins the whole thing, Duke's value of that win goes up. If North Carolina were to fall to Syracuse in the semifinal game, does that knock Duke out?
I just don't see North Carolina bumping from that top five RPI spot, even with a loss. You know, maybe I'm wrong. But, you know, Duke's fate is actually also tied elsewhere, too. When you look at the A-10 tournament, you know, St. Joseph's is a team that going into today, it might have changed briefly with the BU game today, the BU loss today, which actually probably ultimately helps Duke as well. St. Joseph's can become a top 20 win. So we talk about Duke's resume and how they only have this one win. Well, in a matter of days, they might have what we call two quality wins. So the spillover effects are pretty significant, like all over the place. And it's just funny how, like, I mean, you know, the sliding doors effect or whatever you want to call it of just like a win in a different conference bumps one team and moves one team a few percentage points higher in this metric. And we're talking about a whole different resume for the Blue Devils.
So Brady Wambach, again, co-defensive player of the year. Wouldn't it be more appropriate for him to be co-offensive player of the year or just offensive player of the year in the ACC?
I've never understood that. I mean, what makes sense is just make face-off man of the year, right?
Right. Specialist of the year.
Specialist of the year or something else. I mean, the position is way too important to like try to shoehorn it into something else.
Yeah.
It's its own beast. It's, you know, like you said, Mark, to Wharton, we understand the history. We don't need to go into the whole, like, it's typically the best offensive player for the team that goes furthest. But is there a player in the country more important to their team than Brady Wambach? I really don't think so. I mean, the possessive advantage that they've had in most games has been pretty spectacular. But I do want to kind of point out one person that we haven't mentioned his name, and that's Tyler Spano. He's come on really strong for Notre Dame. And, you know, he's certainly not the, like, electric, like, enormous face-off winning percentage that Wambach has. But he, like, really, I think, kind of changes my tune on how far Notre Dame can go in this NCAA tournament and obviously in this conference tournament, too. I have Notre Dame winning. I know we're not really going to get into all the predictions. Having a guy like Tyler Spano, their ability to dictate the pace of this game, their offense might disappear for a quarter. It hasn't been fantastic. But if they can kind of strangle you out, control possession, get enough goals, I can see them going really far.
All right, let's keep it moving. The America East is Thursday, Saturday, semifinal and final. UAlbany had already locked up the number one seed in regular season title, but it took the final day of the regular season to determine the seeding. So Albany is the host of this, and they will play the second game. Usually the top seed will play early to get that little extra rest, but they want that nice nighttime home crowd. They'll play UMBC at 7. The first game will be number 2 seed Bryant versus number 3 seed Vermont at 4 o'clock. And this is Albany's to win, right? Pencil them in as the AQ in this one.
I mean, you got to play the games, but sure. You know, the Danes really dominated this conference this year. And this could be an opportunity for a lot of the country to get to know Silas Richmond if the Danes can make a run, at least get into the quarterfinal weekend where you have a lot of eyeballs and the games are, you know, on the ESPN networks. But UMBC playing with house money, if you will. I know, Dan, you had a great diatribe, what was it, last week or, you know, 2 weeks ago about the athletic department and how poorly they handled the Ryan Moran situation. You know, look, UMBC beat Bryant a couple weeks back, and they're on a roll, and they're playing for each other, and they're playing hard. I just think they're going to run into a tough Dane team and a tough crowd at Albany on Friday night. And yeah, I'm in agreement with you. I think this is Albany's tournament to lose.
Yeah, the Danes are going for three straight America East tournament championships. But like you said, Mark, you got to play the games. 10 years ago, actually, I remember it because D-Fly, it was when Pearl Jam played in Philly and they played 10, the show you didn't actually end up going to. It was a few days.
I'll regret that the rest of my life.
Yeah, I went to those shows. And then a few days after that, I went up to Albany for the America East tournament. And Hartford ended up winning the tournament that year.
Hartford and Vermont in the championship.
Yeah, it was just one of those.
Guess who called that game, the championship? Me.
That would be nice. So, yeah, you got to play the games. You mentioned UMBC. There's something to be said about a team that is just, you know, they're just rallying around each other. You know, they know that nobody was expecting much of them when everything happened in the fall and then, you know, kind of continued into the spring. There should be two guys who are, no matter what happens the rest of the year, there should be two guys who are considered for Coach of the Year in NCAA Division I lacrosse. That's Craig Chick for the job he's done with UMBC, getting them to the conference tournament under these circumstances as an interim head coach and everything that's gone on with them. And then Tim Cox at Siena, taking that program through tragedy and the way that he's led them and been a leader for all of those young men who are dealing with a horrific situation. So glad that people see UMBC playing at this level. But yeah, Albany is a great team. I think their defense is probably underrated in terms of everyone knows about, not everyone, but a lot of people know about Silas Richmond, but like Max Neeson is incredible. And their defense's ability to play a slower pace if they need to, and kind of, you know, win one of those like slug matches, as opposed to, I think everyone thinks of the Great Danes and just running up and down the field like crazy, but they can do it both ways.
In the A-Sun, this will be a Friday, Sunday semifinal and final. Three-way champion in the A-Sun, but the Jacksonville Dolphins get the tiebreaker. They'll be the number one seed. These games will be in Jacksonville. They'll play number 4 Mercer at 3:00 on Friday, May 1st, followed by number 2 seed Utah and number 3 seed Air Force going at it at 6:00 in the nightcap. Dixie, I'll let you start.
I'm not sure how to pick this one when you have balance and unpredictability and teams really from all over the country. You know, we're talking about Jacksonville, Florida, Mercer in Georgia, you know, Atlanta area, Utah, and an Air Force out of Colorado. I mean, what a great, you know, a geographically diverse conference the A-Sun is. You know, the top 3 seeds were decided by tiebreakers. Is this a year Jacksonville can break through? Like, you know, they've got the coach, they have the resources, they've got the facility, but they've always kind of underperformed when it comes to conference tournament time. Or will Utah continue, you know, to wave the flag in the A-Sun and be the team to beat, even though they're the number 2 seed? Mercer, a little bit of an upstart this season, making it to the conference tournament, you know, in an Air Force on any given day. But I really do feel like it's going to come down to Jacksonville and Utah. And I mean, just based on what I know about the teams, watching them, et cetera, I mean, you know, Utah's got 2 guys selected into the PLL draft. They played a very robust out-of-conference schedule, as did Jacksonville. So this is it's anyone's guess, but if there's any time for the Dolphins to do it, it's this weekend at home in northern Florida.
Yeah, Jacksonville, that's a huge, you know, when you have such, you know, these 3 teams were, they all beat each other, and they were all tied for first place in the conference. It went down to, you know, several different tiebreakers to decide who was the number 1 seed. Jacksonville is already the predetermined host in this. I think Utah is going to win this. I like, you know, Nico DePonio, and I like Ryan Steins, and I just think that they have kind of the clearest identity of any of the teams in this. But the thing I like about Jacksonville this year is there was so much hype around them for a few years in a row of like, this is the year that Jacksonville, you know, wins their conference tournament, or this is the year that they're going to beat so-and-so ACC team. And, you know, they've done that. They've had those big upsets and things like that. This year, I kind of felt like the hype disappeared around them, and they might have their deepest roster from top to bottom quietly. You know, they don't quite have, you know, the hype and the mayhem around them. Jack Taylor is an excellent player. He leads them in points. But I don't know. There's something about them that feels like they're going to like maybe give Utah a pretty darn close game, but I kind of like the Utes in this.
All right, moving along to the Atlantic 10. Richmond is the top seed. In my opinion, they're a lock to make the tournament. So this is really about can someone upset them and steal a bid. This tournament will take place at the University of Richmond on Thursday and Saturday. Top seed at Richmond will play UMass, the number 4 seed, at 4 o'clock on Thursday afternoon, followed by High Point and St. Joseph's at 7. That game, High Point St. Joe's, should be a really, really good game. Matt, I'll let you have first serve on this.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's no doubt about it. Richmond is a clear favorite in this conference tournament. You'd be shocked to see any of these teams upset them, just the way that Richmond has this kind of machine-like way about them. Like I said, I'm interested to see if St. Joe's, if they sneak into the top 20, what that means for Duke. That's one of the subplots that doesn't really deal with this conference itself. But High Point is the one team that gives me a little bit of, like, worry if you're the Spiders. They got this face-off guy, Luca Accardo, who, you know, that's one of the recipe for an upset, right? They're a team that when you look at the A-10 tournament last year, you know, they made a run to the championship game. They just have, under Coach Crawley, have seemed to have gotten better as the year has gone on. So maybe they will just have some kind of trick up their sleeve and surprise them and, you know, get a 70% face-off performance. And, you know, maybe that's the recipe. But it's going to be hard-pressed to see the Spiders lose in this one and someone steal a bid there.
St. Joe's gave Richmond their toughest test in conference in 2026. But it's a question mark if they can get by High Point in this one for the reasons that you mentioned. You know, Accardo is a terrific face-off man. And you know, where High Point was beginning of the year to where they are now, they've made a lot of improvement. They've made tremendous strides. But again, this is Richmond's time. And if the unforeseen happens, boy, we're going to have some chaos come Selection Sunday, because Richmond is a lock to be in this tournament when you look at their numbers. I mean, an RPI of 5, you know, strength of schedule, not great, around 20, but the wins, Cornell, Georgetown, Virginia. Like, those are, you know, that this is where, like, wins have to matter, you know, especially when we're talking about Duke. So quality wins, so they're in. Again, we're sitting here on Tuesday night pontificating and, you know, what if in a couple of days when we get the results on Thursday night, we're like, oh my God, I can't believe UMass beat Richmond. You know, I don't see it happening, but this is what we love about this time of year and about these all these bulk of games in a very short period of time.
One thing, if Richmond, you know, assume that they do win, they'll get a home game in the NCAA tournament. That is going to be the atmosphere of the tournament, that Richmond home game. They've been getting awesome crowds all year. They've been bringing the best teams to Richmond. So the students, the fans in the area have seen what it's like when Cornell comes to town. They've seen what it's like when Virginia comes to town. That's going to be an awesome atmosphere. And then obviously if Richmond goes even further than that and goes to Charlottesville, they're going to have a pretty nice crowd bringing them just a little bit I'm not sure which direction that is in terms of the map, but just a few hours away from Richmond to Charlottesville.
In the Big East, looks like this is a one bid conference. Georgetown will play the number 1 seed. They will play number 4 Denver. Number 2 Providence is the host of this tournament on Thursday and Saturday of this weekend. And Providence will play number 3 Villanova at 7:30 on Thursday. The Friars playing some good ball. Can they upset and win this thing?
Let's see. You know, Bobby Benson, they've made strides, especially in conference, to put themselves in a position to be the number 2 seed at the predetermined site. But listen, you know, Georgetown comes in with an RPI around 14. Their RPI is 14. Their top 20 wins are Penn and Loyola. Penn's not going to be in the Ivy League tournament. That win over Loyola could increase in value depending upon how the Greyhounds do Friday at West Point. But yeah, if the Hoyas lose and can be upset in some way, shape, or form, this is a one bid league for sure. And Georgetown will be on the outside looking in. Hard to bet against the Hoyas, though. What have they won? Like 6, 7 straight? Big East championships. Pretty impressive for Kevin Warren and his bunch.
Yeah, seven straight for them. It's pretty remarkable. And I mean, remember like when Warren won that first one, it seems like yesterday and him crying on the sidelines. But now that's old hat for him. He just wins conference tournament championships. The only, and this is a very slim because I just don't think that they have the team to do it. They play Grayson Manning in the semifinals. He's a guy who can get you like, you know, he can have a 20 save game and just like, you know, does he have one of those big games, gets in the shooters' heads, the Connor brothers are just, you know, spraying the ball all over the place because they got this freak in net. That's the only scenario I could maybe see something weird happen, but this is definitely Georgetown's conference.
Yeah, and they've seen them before, so, you know, hopefully
Blitzed them at Peter Barton a few weeks ago.
All right, let's keep it moving. We're almost halfway through, gentlemen. Now we're on to the Big Ten Conference. This tournament will take place at Rutgers University in New Jersey. Before we get into that, let's bring in our guest this week, Michigan's leading scorer, Nick Rude. Please welcome into the show the all-Big Ten attackman from the Michigan Wolverines, Nick Rude. Nick, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Nick, thanks for taking some time out of your schedule. I know you guys are getting ready to head to New Jersey to take part in the Big Ten tournament. You've got the first of two semifinal games on Thursday against Johns Hopkins. Well, before we dive into lacrosse, before we dive into Michigan, I'm a huge fan of your father's, Bobby Roode, pro wrestler. I've said it on pretty much any broadcast since you've been a part of the program when we're in Ann Arbor. I haven't had the opportunity to meet him just yet. But what's it like to be the son of a professional wrestler? Not only a professional wrestler, but someone as popular and as big as your dad. How was that? What was that like growing up? And then now, you know, as you enter your adult years?
Yeah, it's obviously unique. You know, I give a lot of credit to my parents because, like you said, he's very busy. My mom's very busy, so he's always on the road. But whenever he has the chance to come watch me play, he always does. You know, there's times where I'm with him when we're out in public and I got to be the one that takes photos of him with fans. But at the same time, I like it. It's not something that I've really thought about a lot because I've just grown up with it. So it's kind of normal to me. But yeah, a lot of people always come up to me and ask me the same questions of, you know, what's it like to have your dad in the WWE? Like, what's it like to have him as a professional wrestler? And, you know, to me, he's just dad at the end of the day. Like, he's just normal father son.
He cut some legendary promos during his time, especially in TNA. Some of them are just unbelievable. One last question on your dad. I liked him from day one, but I really liked it when he did a heel turn in TNA. Does it matter? Do people get emotional? Do they get upset if they see your dad because he's a you know, quote unquote bad guy?
Yes and no. I think from the TV perspective and like the shows, like in-person shows, they're obviously get, you know, are mad or frustrated at whatever he did. But whenever he's home or whenever, you know, we come back to Peterborough, he's like a lot of people from Peterborough like look up to him. So it's kind of the heat or like the bad reviews that he gets is mostly in person at those live shows rather than, you know, just walking around back home in Peterborough.
That's awesome. That's terrific. How did you get into lacrosse?
So I played lacrosse and hockey growing up in Peterborough. It was kind of like a summer winter thing. Started lacrosse when I was around three, same with hockey. And yeah, I played minor lacrosse in Peterborough growing up. And from the time, you know, I ended my, we'd always do 2 years of each level. So it was like peewee, band, a midget. And when I was in my first year of midget, it was right before COVID. I was recruited to go to Culver Military Academy, which was something that I've heard about because of names like Owen Hilt, Zach Currier, Mikey Robinson, all those guys had went to Culver before me. So I knew what it was about. I didn't really know, you know, what Culver, you know, had in terms of like the military and all that sort of stuff. I just knew that it was a pretty, you know, powerhouse lacrosse school. So I took my visit there. It was a little different compared to high school back home. But yeah, I decided to go there 2020 of August. So it was like right after
COVID. Perfect timing.
Yeah. So I decided to go there. So I did 2 years of high school back home, and then I repeated my sophomore year at Culver. Ended up doing 3 years at Culver, and then my junior year. Didn't really have a lot of field lacrosse experience, honestly, because box lacrosse is a pretty big thing back in Canada. So most of my, you know, experience and, you know, where people saw me was playing box lacrosse and not field. So I was very lucky to be seen my junior year at like this fall play day thing at Brother Rice. We played Western Reserve and Brother Rice, and one of the Michigan coaches was there, thankfully, and he reached out to me and asked if I would love to take a visit. And I said, yeah, I'd love to. So me and my parents came down, and, you know, everything about Michigan I loved from the moment I stepped on campus. You know, the big house, the lacrosse facility, the academics. I know that's a thing that my mom really wanted, was the academics part. So Michigan definitely sold her on that. But, you know, Michigan, it's been the best decision I ever made. And, you know, I give credit to the minor association back home in Peterborough, because that's where, you know, it all started for me. And, you know, all the coaches that I've had back there really grew me into the player who I am today.
When we talk about Culver, Dan has one rule. You have to be familiar with Michael Gianfrancaro.
Yeah. So he actually graduated the year before I went there. So I wasn't able to play with him, but, you know, I was lucky enough to play with, you know, Ty Inglis, Jack Gray, Braden Terrace, all those guys. So, you know, that sort of skill set and leadership that I learned from those guys in high school at a very young age, definitely helped me as well.
That's D-Fly's nephew, Mike G.
That's my nephew. So nice. A question while we're talking about Culver. Currently ranked number one in the nation, mm-hmm. prep lacrosse.
Yeah.
Last week, we interviewed Willem Firth from Cornell, who's a Hill mm-hmm. Academy grad. Yep. And I asked him if he was putting together a sixes team of just Hill Academy alumni, who would he pick? I think Culver could rival him. Might be trouble with the defense, mm-hmm. but offensively, who would be some of the guys you would draft to be on that starting sixes team of Culver alumni? And I have a list. Mike G sent me a list of guys that he would recommend, so we can compare notes.
All right. Let's think about this one. I mean, there's so many names. I'd have to start off with the Peterborough guys. So Zach Currier, definitely got to be one of them.
Definitely. Start with him.
Another Peterborough guy, Owen Hiltz.
Yeah.
That would be my second. I would put Mike Gianvicaro as goalie.
Okay. I like that.
So I got four more. Let's go with Mikey Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
That's three out of six Peterborough guys right there.
Let's throw in the English brothers too.
Yeah, I was just about to say Sam and Ty English.
Uh-huh.
And then let's say my six is Braden Saris. I think he's a very skilled, high IQ player, and I learned a lot from him. Being sort of like an off-ball type attackman that I've kind of transitioned to being here at Michigan. I think I've learned a lot from him, both when I have the ball, when I don't have the ball. I think I was happy enough because he was drafted by, or I guess traded from Coburg to the Peterborough Senior A team back home. So this summer I was able to, you know, spend some time with him in the locker room. When my junior A season ended, I was able to, you know, get called up to the senior A's. Didn't play in a game, but just able to hang out in the locker room with all those other guys and, you know, learn from them. Robert Hope was my coach. I don't know if you guys know who that is, but very, very talented and, you know, has a lot of lacrosse knowledge. So, you know, hearing from him as a coach and then hearing from him as a captain in the locker room and the senior A room was something that I appreciated a lot. So, yeah, going back to my sixth guy, I'd say Braden Terrace, just because I learned a lot from him.
It's a solid group, stacked group.
Real solid. You win some games.
Not sure about the defense. Definitely Courier and the Englishes, but you got to have some offensive threats.
This is a quote from your goalie, Mike Gianfacaro. Culver boys certainly aren't known for great defense. So he was a true depiction.
Wow. So, Nick, your first couple seasons in Ann Arbor, you experienced some injuries. Mm-hmm. But this year, it's been really your breakout season. You know, 34 goals, second team all Big Ten. What did missing time teach you about when you actually have been able to step on the field and contribute?
Yeah, obviously the two injuries definitely sucked. My freshman year with my knee, which I didn't really miss a lot of time, but just, you know, being on the sideline sucked because I wasn't in full pads and just having to watch practice. And, you know, last year I broke my hand during the Maryland game in the second quarter. Didn't know it was broken at the time. I don't know if you guys remember, but after the goal, I was like kind of laying down. I lost like all feeling in my arm and my hand. And I remember Aiden Mulholland comes up to me. He's like, get up. Like what a goal. Just trying to fire me up. I'm like, just give me a couple seconds. Like I can't really feel anything at the moment. So anyways, after that goal, I ran over to the sideline to our trainer, Tony, who's one of the best trainers I've ever worked with. And he was like, you know, all we can do is tape it up. If you feel good to play, I'm not going to stop you, but you know, I am worried for you, but if you feel like you're good to play, we'll just tape it up for right now. And then after the game, we'll go and look at it. So after that hit, I didn't really do much on the field, except for, you know, I was lucky enough to be in the position to score that goal at the end of the game, in overtime or triple overtime. But yeah, I think from, you know, especially last year, breaking my hand and, you know, going from that all-time high to realizing I had to get surgery and pins put in my thumb and hand, it sucked because, you know, it's definitely, we're starting to figure out our stride at that point of our season. And then, you know, obviously that injury came and Coach Bita came up to me. He's at Rutgers now, but he said, I don't want you to disappear. I want you to stay by my hip. I want you to stay with the offense. I want you to learn and, you know, be a vocal point for this group. And so that's exactly what I did, being on the sidelines during the game. I held the iPad. I talked to the attackmen, whether it was Cohen, Alex Lobel. Jack Jenkins obviously got hurt last year too, which sucked. But, you know, just whenever those guys came off the field, I always had something to say to them, whether it be, you know, off-ball movement or something that they could have done in the play that they might have not have seen. So I think from that aspect, while I was talking to them about what they could have done, I was also instilling that in my head. So when I came back on the field, I knew that, you know, I could do these exact same things. Obviously, a big part of me being injured was watching a lot of film, helping those guys. And, you know, I think that transitioned into this year of watching, you know, my old self on the field and, you know, guys like, I give a lot of credit to Justin Tiernan. I still talk to him to this day, but he's one of the players that was probably the best off-ball attackman that I've ever seen and I've had the opportunity to play with and learn from. So even to this day, I still talk to him, you know, learn things, whether it be off-ball movement, things with the ball. Yeah, and, you know, just from being injured, I think I definitely learned a lot from an IQ standpoint of what to do on the field.
The Wolverines have had an up-and-down season, but you're on a roll right now, playing in the Big Ten semifinals this week with mm-hmm. a chance to win the Big Ten and go to the NCAA tournament. Not an uncommon thing, position for the Wolverines to be in. You've done it in 2023 and 2024. How'd you guys rebound from the loss to Ohio State in that final game and then rebound for a win? And how do you feel? What's is there momentum in the locker room? And how do you guys feel going into the semifinals this weekend?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it goes back before Ohio State. We lost 7 straight, I'm pretty sure it was. And one of the things that the leadership group talked about was the belief aspect. I don't think that in the 7 weeks that we were kind of in a slump, we lost any sort of belief. And with that, we keep talking about and keep pushing the idea of, the process of winning and process and practice. And, the things that we do in practice, it might not translate into a game. But, continuing that process and continuing that belief and, from the coaches to the players of belief and the players to the coaches believing, like, it's a whole connected group that I think is very special and not a lot of teams have what we have in our locker room. And, like you said, we're hitting our stride at the perfect time. We've said it from day one that, we don't want to be playing our best across in February and March. We want to be playing our best across the end of April and into May. And I think that's exactly what we're doing right now. We're continuing that idea of process and, continuing our belief and, things might not go our way in a game, but, staying level-headed, not getting too high or too low, I think is what has contributed to our success.
Thursday, you will play Johns Hopkins in semifinals. What do the Wolverines need to do to get a win against Johns Hopkins?
Simple. I think just keeping things simple, doing things that make us successful and not steering away from, things that are outside of our toolbox or our inventory. That's, I guess, one of the main things that we've been talking about over the last few weeks, whether it was against Rutgers or against Penn State. It's keeping that simplicity of, moving the ball, changing it through X, not trying to hit that home run off the first dodge. Obviously, we didn't have the greatest game when we played them a few weeks ago, but I think going back to, the belief in this process and this motivation that we have in our locker room right now, I'm very excited to be able to play them again and have the opportunity to, make a run at this thing.
Ready for some quick hitters?
Let's do it.
All right. What's your all-time favorite sports team? Any sport?
Toronto Maple Leafs, which is rough because they disappoint me every year, but...
What's the best Michigan lacrosse tradition?
Ooh, the fight song after we win.
Zingerman's Deli or Maize and Blue?
Maize and Blue.
What's your favorite sandwich?
I had Maize and Blue yesterday. It was so good.
What'd you get?
I'm a big buffalo chicken wrap. Anything buffalo chicken, whether it's a sandwich wrap, so that's always my go-to when I go there.
Why do you wear number 15?
Honestly, that's a great question. So in hockey, I know this doesn't relate to lacrosse, but in hockey, when I wore number 3 in hockey for like my first 5 to 6 years, but it was a defensive number and I was obviously a forward. But the reason why I picked 3 was because my first game ever, we walked into the locker room and I thought I had to pick the number that was my age. So I picked number 3. And then obviously when I got older, I transitioned to 93, so 3 threes is 9, kept 3 at the end. 15, I think I've always just kind of the same thing. My first ever game, it was like house league or whatever it was, I walked in the room and chose 15, and I've stuck with it. There was a couple years where I had to, when I played for Team Ontario, I had to choose to 5 because someone else is wearing 15, but I've always kept that 5 for no reason other than I think when I was a kid, that was the first jersey I picked and I've stuck with it ever since.
That's a quality answer there. What's your favorite thing about being from Peterborough?
The lacrosse community. Ever since I was a kid, I've went with my parents to the Senior A Lakers games, being around guys like John Grant Jr., Tracy Kolesky, Sean Evans, and now growing up again, playing minor all the way through and playing 5 years of junior A, being coached by, Robert Hope, Holden Cotone. There's so many big names that you can list that are, lacrosse greats and they're from Peterborough. So, just growing up in that family, in that community and, still being close and friends with all those people is pretty awesome.
What was your go-to order at the Shack?
The Shack. It was definitely the buffalo chicken sandwich.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's the Shack? Is that another Culver thing?
The Shack is like a, it's like the one restaurant that's on campus. And I think it was honestly like built the year before I got there. They had it within the dining hall, if I'm not mistaken. They had it like the Shack or whatever, like the little restaurant underneath the dining hall. And then they built this, yeah, like restaurant type thing.
Yeah. It's only place you can get like different food than the dining hall.
Buffalo chicken sandwich was the go-to.
All right. If you're when your family's in town in Ann Arbor, where's the best place to go to get a post-game meal?
I'm a big fan of Knight's Steakhouse. And it's funny. So I went with Jackie Weller and his dad. And this was last year. And again, going back to the buffalo chicken, they had buffalo chicken tacos, but they were an appetizer. But they were like pretty big. There was like three tacos, but they were loaded with chicken. And so I got two orders of those, and they both started dying laughing at me because I'm like, we're going to this steakhouse, and I ordered six buffalo chicken tacos. which doesn't make any sense. But then they took it off their menu. So when my parents came, it was the Maryland game that we played here after that tough loss. And, you know, we went to dinner. I wanted to go to Knight's, but they have an unbelievable burger there. So that's my spot. That's my go-to for sure.
Did you ask them to dip the burger in buffalo chicken sauce?
No. No. No, I did not.
But sure did the game.
who's the best chef or cook on the Michigan lacrosse team?
McKnight Pedersen, hands down. So our team is split up into scrums, and I was very thankful to be named one of the scrum leaders this year. And so we had the scrum Thanksgiving dinner, and Knighter made the whole turkey, bought the turkey from the grocery store, you know, put it in the oven, like baked it all day. He loves cooking. Like any time that he wants, you know, guys to come over, be like, I'll cook, let me cook something. So he's definitely the best cook on the team for sure.
We've asked the same question to just about every player we've interviewed all season, and it seems like there's one guy on every team that's the main cook. Chef, does he have an Instagram account to show off the food that he cooks or eats?
He is not. I should tell him to make one.
Yeah, he's gone. Besides the men's lacrosse team, which team at Michigan, which Wolverine team would you say you have the most friends on?
I would say probably hockey. I think we're pretty close with them, specifically my grade. I'm pretty close with Nick Moldenhauer and Garrett Shipsky. So, you know, those guys, we were in the dorms together our freshman year. So getting to know them then, and then over the past couple of years, whether it's in the academic building or just around campus. Yeah, I would say definitely hockey. Our team is very close. We're a close-knit group. So I think there's a lot of people on our team that are friends with many different sports teams, but personally myself, I would say hockey.
All right, last question. If Dixie or I walk into the Wolverines locker room, who's running the aux and what kind of music are we most likely to hear?
Tommy Renner on aux for sure. Actually, it depends. So pre-game, I would say Tommy Renner. And I think the genres are mixed, whether it's EDM, hip hop, rap. I think there's a variety of different genres that are played. And then, so we have, for our practice, we have the Hammer, which is like the hardest working player of practice. And so whoever has the Hammer the day before gets aux during practice. And I would say one of the most electric aux performances was Max Bonner before, I think it was Rutgers, the week of Rutgers. And, you know, I think from that day, it just like changed everything in our locker room. And, you know, obviously it contributed, or I think it contributed to our success that we had those 2 weeks and what we're having right now. I think that day. We were in the ITC, which is like the indoor facility, and he played Sandstorm. And we were doing this drill, and for the whole 8 minutes of the drill, you could see on film, like, everyone's just, like, jumping around, like, dancing. Like, it was like its whole, like, concert. It was pretty unreal.
You got to keep him on aux this weekend.
Yeah.
Keep the vibe
yeah,
going.
For sure.
Hey, Nick, thanks for joining us on the D-Flying Dixie podcast. Best of luck to you and the Wolverines.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Dixie, you were super excited to talk to him. If you've listened to our podcast for years, you know Dixie's a huge wrestling fan. And it was good to talk some wrestling with Nick.
It was great because, I mean, I've opined and, you know, Bobby Roode when we're in Ann Arbor and off the air when we were kind of just small talking, getting to know one another, the three of us. He goes, oh, yeah, my dad's played me that audio before, you know, and then we didn't really ask him why, but maybe his dad's like, look, this guy knows who I am, or, you know, but Bobby Roode, man, I'm telling you, he was bad, great tag team champion in TNA, heavyweight champion in TNA. Again, I don't watch WWE that much, so I didn't really follow the whole, you know, glorious one, but whenever you mention Bobby Roode to anybody, they say, oh, the glorious one. That's how they remember Bobby Roode from WWE. Not me. Old school. TNA.
Well, the Michigan Wolverines have new life. It seems like then they get to the Big Ten tournament. This is their time to shine. They've had an up-and-down season, but they have beaten their arch rivals to advance to the Big Ten semifinals, where they will play top-seeded Johns Hopkins. This will be a Thursday-Saturday affair at Rutgers. The first game is at 3:00. That's when Hopkins plays Michigan. It's on BTN. Dixie, you'll be on the call for this. And then in the nightcap, Penn State plays Maryland. Penn State's the 2 seed. Maryland's the 3. That game will be at 6:00. 4-way tie atop the Big Ten standings to finish the regular season. Hopkins gets the top seed by virtue of the tiebreaker. This is really anybody's to win, right? This one's up in the air.
In a year of wide open, the Big Ten tournament is wide open. Let's rewind 2 years ago. These are the exact matchups in Columbus. Hopkins was the 1 seed. Michigan was the 4 that year. And Michigan, they ran Hopkins off the field. Then in a nightcap, I can't remember who was the 2 or the 3, but Penn State dominated Maryland. I mean, just dominated them. And then Michigan beat Penn State for the Big Ten championship, their second tournament title in a row. Hopkins really dominated Michigan at Homewood Field back in March. I feel like I was there for the turnaround of the Michigan season. It was Easter Sunday. They were losing by, I think, 3 goals to Rutgers at halftime. No reason to believe that these guys were not going to lose their 8th game in a row in the season. And they just came out in the second half, and Kevin Connery told us at halftime, the message was, play like a Wolverine. And they played like a pack of Wolverines. They were, you know, Hunter Taylor was really good in goal, and Udell, Shanahan, Gatto offensively got the job done. You know, so this is a different Michigan team playing with a whole lot more confidence against Johns Hopkins team. It's been off for about 10 days after knocking off Maryland in dramatic fashion at Homewood Field. And this is a Hopkins team. It'll be really interesting to see how they, if they win this game, how they'll handle the 2 games in 3 days when they run that first midfield pretty much 75% of the time. But Matt Collison showed up big at Homewood a couple weeks ago, Big Ten Offensive Player of the Year. You know, Penn State, Maryland. Maryland played zone against the Nittany Lions in Happy Valley or State College a few weeks back. I don't know if that happens again. I think I like the development of this Maryland defense, minus Will Schaller. Peter Lake has emerged as really, I mean, you're talking about a guy probably could be, I'm going to say, third team All-American this year, like somewhere around there, if not higher. And Penn State, Hunter Aquino getting his legs underneath of him, more comfortable against Rutgers. He was rusty, it looked like, against Michigan, a loss at home on senior day. And you can kind of convey that over to Eric Spanos. His first game back after missing about 3-4 games was against Penn State. And he was, I think, 0 for 7 shooting. But he still has that incredible hesitation move, that little hitch into like a face dodge or a split dodge. So I think this is going to be a game featuring the two best players offensively, Aquino, Spanos, who can play better, what goalie plays better, and they'll punch their ticket to Saturday for the championship.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, John Tillman earlier this year called the Big Ten the AFC North of lacrosse. I think he's used that expression in years past as well. And, you know, it's really true, right? These teams just kind of beat each other up. I don't think any of them particularly like each other. I don't think you're going to see what people would call pretty lacrosse, or like, you know, lacrosse that like is going to break scoreboards or anything like that. But it is going to have the most just like pure like tension drama in the whole thing, particularly when you consider the postseason implications that are going to be in this game, in this tournament. Hopkins, you know, feels the most secure, but weirder stuff has happened, right? You know, they lose to Michigan early, and, you know, someone beats Richmond in the A-10, and, you know, stuff starts to get a little bit hairy there. But Maryland-Penn State, man, this game just feels like as big as it can possibly get. You know, program like Maryland that, you know, I know just a few years ago they had that, you know, when they – you know, they kind of had a little dip and they reinvented themselves and then went to the Final Four. But like, this is just not a program that's been used to this level of like uncertainty around their season. The fact that like, you know, they've kind of just had these stretches where they just did not look like a good team flat out. And Mark, you're totally right. Like I went to their first two or three home games. I covered them, and defensively, just like the whole time I was like, what is this Maryland defense that I'm watching? It was just a lot of ball watching, really slow foot speed. They've seemed to turn that around and just kind of rallied. And man, when you consider that this game might be for like who makes it to the NCAA tournament, this Maryland versus Penn State game, wow, that is going to be just a physical battle. And like, I want to be sideline field level for this, just to like hear the crunch, because this is going to feel like a football game more than a lacrosse game.
The winner of this game feels pretty good. The loser is sweating it on Selection Sunday.
That's exactly how I describe it. Is like the winner, you can exhale a little bit. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't think either of these coaches will actually exhale in that time. But if you're the loser, you have a very, very tense 4 days between this game finishing and then watching and hoping that something weird doesn't happen in the A-10. Or just, you know, Duke's RPI doesn't get better, you know, even though they're not playing and things like that. You're really, really kind of refreshing the data over and over again if you lose this first game.
Yeah, they're sweating it out for sure. In the CAA, the Towson Tigers are the number one seed and the host for this Thursday-Saturday conference tournament. Tigers will play number 4 Monmouth at 4:00. Fans can catch both these games on Flow College.
Come on, are you serious?
Your favorite. They rebrand it, Dixie, because it's a different product now. It's not Flow Sports anymore. It's Flow College.
Wow. So yeah. This conference tournament is going to be on that garbage.
Feel the flow, Dixie. Feel the flow.
Yeah, feel the flow.
That sucks, man. That really does stink.
And the second semifinal will feature the number 2 Drexel Dragons will play number 3 Stony Brook at 7 on Flow College, with the championship game at 3:30 on Flow College on Saturday. The Tigers, thinking back to like the America East, the Tigers are sort of like the heavy favorites in this one, right? They're sort of like an Albany, sitting there like an Albany. Dixie, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, they got the best player in the conference in Mikey Weischer, and they have some great wins this year. You know, they knocked off Virginia. That's a great win for them. But this is a one bid league, obviously, even with the win to Virginia. You know, you look at Towson's metrics, 20 in the RPI. You know, the strength of schedule is not going to be all that, you know, a benefit to them. And they really, other than Stony Brook, really didn't struggle all that much in the CAA regular season. You know, they beat Drexel 14-10, Monmouth, who they play in the first round, 15-10. You know, dominated Hampton, dominated Fairfield, dominated Hofstra this past weekend, 20-3. I can't remember a time I've seen a score that lopsided in the in the Hofstra-Towson series. So this is theirs to lose. And they've been to the NCAA tournament the last 2 years. They've just drawn really tough matchups in the dome against Syracuse, and then last year in Tiger Woods playing Princeton. We'll see what happens, but I'd be surprised if anybody other than Towson is raising the CAA trophy on Saturday.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, they're also getting healthy. They've gotten healthier as the year has gone on. Their face-off unit has been bolstered. Their attack has been bolstered. So not only are they the best team, but they're the best team, and probably the last 3 or 4 weeks or so of the season, they've gotten even better. So I really expect them to kind of roll. And man, this career that Mikey Weissar has had, he's a man of few words, but man, he just lets his play stand for itself and is really incredible. Going to go down as one of Towson's all-time greats.
He's our all-time points leader now.
Yeah.
I mean, he overtook guys named Bob Grebe, Glenn Smith, and Jim Darcangelo. You know, I mean, those are some pretty significant names in Towson lacrosse lore. Did I hear right or see right? Ronan Fitzpatrick is back for Towson?
He's back. Yeah, he came back a few weeks ago.
When did he do his injury?
So he was going to – he was injured. I'm not sure when the injury happened, but he was injured as of the beginning of the season and was thinking about redshirting, but just kind of changed his mind in terms of, like, you know, didn't want to have to do an extra year. So he came back, and that's, you know, extra firepower to this offense, a great off-ball presence for them. Really kind of the spillover effect of him being back really bolsters their midfield and just allows, you know, even more depth at that offense. They've got a lot of guys. When you know, Villa Gomez was a guy who was injured last year. The Rooster, Alex Roussel, Ryan Schreier. They've got some, like, really – it goes pretty deep. They're talented guys on that roster. So I like Towson to kind of roll in this conference pretty clearly.
Tigers are a team that you can root for. This is a fun team to watch this season. All right, moving on to the Ivy League, one of the most anticipated tournaments, with 4 of the top 13 teams in the country, kind of similar to the ACC. This will be a Friday-Sunday affair. On Friday, the hosts, number 1 seed Cornell, will play number 4 seed Harvard, 4 o'clock on ESPNU. A little happy hour lacrosse on Friday, with Princeton, the 2 seed, taking on number 3 Yale at 6:30 in the second game. This is a tournament that, you know, in my opinion, Cornell and Princeton are locks for this, and Harvard and Yale are sort of trying to play their way in, and could use a really significant win on Friday in the semifinals. Matt, you want to start?
We already talked about the ACC and how it has just such incredible talent. Take, you know, almost that level of talent, but add in conference tournament implications in terms of, like, Yale's playing to make its way from being, you know, bubble out into in, and Harvard is, you know, making sure they don't go from bubble in to out, you know, secure their spot. So you kind of add all that to the level of talent that is on the field for every team. It's going to be pretty awesome. It's a good thing that it's not the same time as the Big Ten ones. So you can watch Dixie, and then you can also watch the Ivy League games on the next day. Yale is one of, like, the incredible stories of this year, really, when you think about how they've not only from improvement from last year, but improvement within this year and how they've seemed to kind of right the ship. Their defense, you know, was not good the past few years. Noah Faulkner came in. I think you've seen the improvement happen, you know, about somewhere in the midway point of this season. Everything started to really click for them. So Yale is a team that's, you know, maybe trying to upset the apple cart here. But I think you legitimately have, I would say, you know, when I'm looking even bigger picture, you have 2 national championship contenders that are going to be playing in this, in Cornell and Princeton. Harvard and Yale are very good teams. I don't currently think of either of them as national championship contenders. But Cornell and Princeton are as good as it gets in the country. I think Cornell maybe has even been a little bit under the radar this year, despite being the defending national champions. And Willem Firth probably should be in that conversation when we're talking about to Wharton, you know, caliber players. It's going to be awesome. And Cornell's a team that, you know, is also getting healthier with Nikolic coming back. And, you know, Cascaden missed a little bit of time, but then he came back. So you're going to see the best of all of these teams, and they bring out the best in each other, and it's an awesome conference tournament.
I mean, I think other than the Patriot League, the Ivy is the closest in terms of competition level, in terms of how close these guys are to one another. Harvard's lost 4 out of the last 5. But they have played Princeton incredibly tough, and then they just played Cornell incredibly tough. One goal lost to Princeton, 2 goal loss to Cornell. You mentioned Yale's improvement, and then Cornell and, you know, Princeton, you know, have been on a different level this year. I think Cornell really kind of got back into the conversation with that win at Class of 52 Stadium a few weeks back. No one really saw that one coming. I equate that a little bit too. I never forget, you know, I was at the gym back in the fall and just kind of waiting for Indiana football to lose. And they were going to Illinois, or Illinois was coming into Indiana, and you're watching the College Game Day, and they go to pick, and everyone picks Illinois. Everybody picks Illinois. And I think that's the way we were a couple weeks ago against Princeton. Really didn't give Cornell much of a shot, but that's a really good lacrosse team. This is going to be I think it's going to be high scoring. I think it's going to be entertaining. Right now, Princeton at an RPI of 3, Cornell's at a 7, Harvard at an 11, and then Yale sitting at 13. Yale's going to be big Penn State fans this weekend because they lost bad to the Nittany Lions and want that, you know, as much of a loss can have luster because they took a hit with BU losing earlier this evening. Yeah, this is anybody's to win, but at the end of the day, I think that, you know, does it go back to Princeton being that team that probably carries the best opportunity for the Ivies to capture a national title in 2026, I should say, because Cornell did it last year, obviously.
On to the MAC, where Merrimack beat Quinnipiac in Sunday's play-in 4-5 matchup. So Merrimack will take on Siena, the number one seed, and host. This will be a Thursday-Saturday conference tournament. Siena will play Merrimack, as I said, at noon on Thursday, followed by number two seed Marist and number three seed Sacred Heart at 4 o'clock. Matt Kinnear, what are your thoughts?
The MAC each year brings us one of the best games of this conference tournament weekend. Last year, it was Marist versus Siena. It was an overtime game that was, you know, just one of those wild momentum swings. So it's definitely you should definitely watch this because there's going to be something, even if you don't know the teams, you don't know the personnel, there's just going to be something wild that happens. I do think that the top three teams, so Siena, Marist, and Sacred Heart, any of them can beat each other. You know, there's certainly not, I think Siena is a favorite, but it's not by much. So kind of you got to go and play the game. Siena is one of the best stories in college lacrosse in terms of how they have continued on after Liam Gleason's passing. Liam was, you know, super charismatic guy who brought that program back to, you know, being an annual contender in that conference. You know, it used to be under Coach Breck for a while, and then it kind of fell on some times when it wasn't really that relevant, and then Coach Gleason brought them back to that. That, you know, this offseason when Gleason passed away, they could have, you know, it could have gone a different way. It could have gone a way where, you know, they just didn't emotionally weren't able to handle this season, and no one would have blamed them. But they have certainly brought everything onto the field, and they're doing it without their leading scorer. Patrick Radomski was injured halfway through the season. He might still be the NCAA points per game leader after, you know, he got injured in that game against Marist that they played. But I really like the way that, you know, they've got an awesome faceoff guy in Logan Bannock. They've got really deep offensive talent. There's a lot to like about this team. It's definitely the feel-good story, but Marist and Sacred Heart are really good teams that, you know, I think certainly this will be a really fun one to watch.
We talked about UMBC and how they're playing inspired lacrosse. Siena definitely fits that category. Losing Coach Gleason, they've done an incredible job earning the number one seed, and really, I guess, you know, they're the favorite coming into this weekend, albeit by not much, but people will be able to see this on ESPNU, and that's an awesome thing to give these guys the stage to showcase their talents and the exciting brand of lacrosse. that they play. Sacred Heart was kind of a darling team, or has been a darling team the last couple years. And then this year, I know there were a lot of folks putting them in the top 20. They've hit a rough patch as of late, but still are very, very dangerous. So really, this is a wide open tournament. I could see Siena, Marist, or Sacred Heart win this championship and would not be surprised. But to your point, Matt, I think this is going to be entertaining. Three games, and definitely get yourself in front of a TV on Saturday at noon.
Yeah, and you know, just a few weeks back, Albany hosted that larger than life game in honor of Liam Gleason. They planted a tree in his memory and did a lot of stuff. They were, you know, giving out information about organ donation. Liam, you know, saved some lives on the way out with you know, donating his organs, and that was a really special, you know, night in the capital region for lacrosse. And look at the schedule on, you know, Saturday conference tournament days. They could have two champions crowned, you know, within a few, you know, just miles from each other. Siena and Albany are going to be playing just within a few hours of, you know, the games will be finishing within a few hours of each other, potentially two champions, all with Coach Gleason's fingerprints all over them. So that could be a really, really special time for everyone in the capital region and everyone involved with both programs, but particularly the Siena players for the way that they battle through this.
Well said, Matt. Be sure to catch those games in the MAC. In the NEC, this will be a Thursday-Saturday conference tournament. The number one seed is Robert Morris, and they will host the tournament in Pittsburgh as well. They will play number four VMI at 5 o'clock on Thursday. Number two LIU plays number three Cleveland State on Thursday evening at 8 o'clock. And I feel like this is a Robert Morris heavy favorite in this one as well.
Had them forever ago in the season opener for Hopkins and the Colonials in Baltimore, a game that was moved off of, I think that would have been January 31st, one of those, you know, and it was postponed for a couple days so it could go from 6 degrees to 9 degrees on Homewood Field in much, much safer conditions. But, you know, watching Robert Morris that game, I just felt like I expected so much more, maybe because I didn't expect much out of Hopkins, and Hopkins really showed up that day, and Robert Morris lost one of their best defenders. But you got to give a lot of credit. This program, under Andrew McMinn, this program became a winner, and Craig McDonald has continued that standard, continued that tradition. Again, another very, well, probably because of Cleveland State, but you got Pittsburgh, you got Virginia, you got the Island, then you got Cleveland. You don't live in Cleveland. No, it's the old Sam Weiss diatribe. But look, I think this is Robert Morris's tournament. They're the favorite in this. And but Long Island University's made some strides over the last couple of years, and I would not be surprised if they could spring the upset. But I'm a believer. I'm a believer in Bobby Moe.
Yeah, LIU's done a great job in its transition, you know, from D2, and then, you know, the universities up there merged, and then, you know, they emerged as this program, as the LIU Sharks. Eric Wolf coached them, and then now it's Coach Jordan there. He came from Mercy, where he took them to a national championship at the D2 level. And so they're a very good team. You know, it's certainly Robert Morris is the favorite. I wouldn't expect a blowout by any means. One cool subplot is the semifinal game last year in the NEC was Robert Morris versus LIU. And Callum Brennan, who is, you know, one of the leading scorers on the Colonial team, had 8 goals in that game. So it would be interesting to see if those two teams meet in a championship game, does he go off? And that's just kind of the MO of Robert Morris, right? You have these Canadian guys who put up 1 million goals and just have a few assists. They've got a few of them on that team. And they always seem to score a ton of goals in the biggest moments. So excited to see what happens this weekend for that conference tournament.
And finally, we save the best for last. The Patriot League, Matt Kinnear, in your article, you rank this on the chaos meter as unhinged. meaning it is the most chaotic conference tournament. And we've already seen it tonight as two road teams, the lower seeded teams, will advance to the semifinals by winning in overtime each of those games. So, Matt, you have predicted this perfectly well. On Friday, Army will be the host of the tournament and the number one seed. Army will play Lehigh at 4 o'clock on CBS Sports Network. Loyola, the Greyhounds, are the number two seed. They will play Colgate, who again won in overtime over Bucknell, in the second game at 7:30. Who wants to go first?
Well, let me just say, I mean, unhinged. Is there any like more unhinged way to end a game than overtime? A goalie throwing the ball the length of the field to a guy wide open on the crease who scored, what, his fifth goal of the game. That is just such a Patriot League way to end a game. And then to be followed up by, you know, and that was a 16-15 result. And then to be followed up by a 6-5 overtime game on the road by a team that you're used to putting up a ton of goals and having a bunch of, like, you know, chaos, 10-man ride, up and down the field, all this stuff. So you just legitimately don't know what you're going to get in terms of who's going to win, but what kind of game you're going to get. Like, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if any of these games are, you know, nearing 15, 16 goals for each team, or if they just, like, end up being, like, a 6-4, like, half-field game. It really is just the league where anything can happen.
You mentioned the leap that Yale has made defensively this year. You could say the same about Loyola on the offensive end of the field. By the way, Patriot League coaching staff of the year, featuring graduate assistant Matt Dixon. So I know he's very proud of that. He's had a ton of fun with this team.
A lot of people give Justin Ward a lot of credit for their turnaround on offense, but I've been saying it all year long that it's Matt Dixon who's really been making the difference.
You know what? He's a big contributor, and as is Sean Cottle. Like any great leader, Justin Ward delegates. He doesn't try to do it all himself. So he's given responsibilities to Coach Cottle. He's given responsibilities to Coach Dixon, and the three of them have, you know, Justin is the boss, and he's the leader, and he's the biggest difference. In Loyola, much like Noah Faulkner can be attributed to the difference in Yale this year. But is this the year Army can put it together and break through? I don't want to use the word break through, but they've been upset in the Patriot League tournament the last couple of seasons with a roster arguably better than this one. But this team has really shown its mettle lately, especially when they came into Baltimore. And Loyola at the time was kind of the sexy pick to beat Army at Ridley. And Army handled the Greyhounds after a tight first quarter. They ran away with it. But they've got to get by a scrappy Lehigh team first that has some really good defenders and really good goaltending. And then Colgate, you want to talk about a team with house money. I mean, I think with their win over Bucknell, they moved to 6-8. And they're going to try to create havoc and chaos all over the field. That's how they play. How does Loyola handle it? But this should be a great environment at Mikey Stadium, West Point. Wide open, like you just said. I can remember a couple of years ago going into the last game of the regular season. It was Army at Loyola at Ridley. So this would have been 2024. If Loyola won, they were the number one seed. Loyola loses, they could have gone as low as 6, and that's where they went. Like, that's how bunched up this was a couple years ago. A little bit more separation this year, but when you see the 6 and the 5 win their semifinal games on the road, unhinged is the word that Matt Kinnear used in his written piece, and I think it's applicable.
Yeah, and you look at, I mean, the last day of the season, right? Navy and Loyola goes down to the final possession of the game, and Navy's sitting home now. When, like, they're a team that you could definitely have seen them win a game or two in this conference tournament for sure. Really, it's just an incredible, you know, it's an incredible thing to watch. And Army was a team that, like, I'm guilty of. They lost too many players. They don't have as much talent as they did. The face-off is going to be, you know, not something they can rely on as steadily as they did for the past few years. And they lose those three games, and you kind of like all that stuff just all comes out there. But man, they stayed the course. They're a good team. They're solid. They're tough as nails, as you would expect. And then just watching that game against Loyola, because like you said, Mark, like Loyola, like, you know, there was a point in, after you guys did the podcast interview with Watkinson, I feel like you guys were riding the wave there of Loyola, like really coming back to where we expect that program to be, because that's one of the great programs in this sport. Watching what Army was able to do against them was like, wow, man, I discounted Army way too early. So in the similar way to like some of these other teams, maybe there's a little bit of just like not having the spotlight, not everybody talking about like, are you going to be the team that gets snubbed this year? You know, I don't think that narrative has been around as much as it was last year. Maybe that'll be good for them. Maybe it's a little pressure off of them. Maybe they can kind of just do their thing. But I don't know. Nobody, if anyone tells you what's going to happen in this conference tournament, they're just crazy. Like there's nothing you can predict.
Well, that's about as fine a point as you can put on it, Matt. So thank you for that. Fans, this is the best weekend of the year. This is where every game is very meaningful. The competition levels, because it's the four best teams in every conference playing, it's very even. Get out, watch some games in person. If you can't get to a game, well, line up the TV on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Get ready, because Selection Sunday is coming, whether you like it or not. Before you know it, the NCAA tournament will be upon us.
9:30 Sunday night, ESPNU. I believe it's Anish Quentin Clark will be in the studio. 9:00 is a women's selection show.
It's happening. It's happening. So make your plans. All right, guys. Dixie, we got Matt Kinnear on. We got to talk about music. It's time for our
Kinnear. We always do when Kinnear comes on. We have to. Talk about something different.
We have to. So a couple weekends ago, some neighbors had planned, maybe like a month ago, they're like, hey, there's this a tribute band coming to Columbia where we live. Let's get some people together and go see it. And it was R.E.M., the band R.E.M. Mm-hmm. Right. We had a really fun time. The band sounded great. They played all their hit songs and only their hit songs. So it was fantastic. I had a really fun time. It made me think, who are some of the other great tribute bands that I've seen? And I want to know who bands that you've seen. What tribute bands have you seen that are any good? While you guys think about it a little bit. And I started thinking, you've seen some bad tribute. Well, not, I don't mean just a cover band that plays a whole bunch of others. I mean like a band that is dedicated to one group's music, and that's what they play. So this REM band, it was like a reunion for them, so they hadn't played in a while, so they published their set list ahead, so it was really great. There were a couple named like songs I wasn't familiar with. I got a chance to listen to them like the day of the show. So I knew every song they played. It was really fun. But I've been to the Jersey Shore many times, and I've run into some Bruce Springsteen tribute bands, and they're pretty good, always fun. But what I don't like is when the guy tries to like be Bruce Springsteen, you know, and he's like has to pick an era, and he's like, I'm going to be Bruce Dorn, born in the USA. And he's got like the handkerchief in the back pocket and the vest on. I've seen an Elvis tribute band, an Elvis performer. That was a good show. Saw that at the Meyerhoff, maybe downtown Baltimore. Great place to watch a good performance. And that guy did old Elvis, young Elvis, I should say. And then, like, fat lounge singer Elvis. And it was, like, two different eras.
Peanut butter banana sandwich Elvis.
Yeah. The show is broken up into, like, two parts. But I got to say, maybe the best tribute band I've ever seen. I was on vacation in Dominican Republic. And, like, they, you know, they have different entertainment each night. And the one night, they had a Beatles tribute band. It was, like, four young Dominican guys.
I want to hold your hand.
They were.
I want to hold your hand.
So good. They were so good. They sounded just like the Beatles, but they had the like the mop top haircuts and the matching like gray suits that the Beatles wore, probably like 1964,
1963. Excellent. I disagree with your point, like the guy wanting to be Bruce Springsteen. If you're going to do a tribute band, I want you to go as all in as you possibly can. Like, I want you to get reconstructive surgery. I want you to put in, like, hair plugs or whatever. Like, you need to, like, just – if if you're putting that other band's name on the marquee,
okay,
like do the whole thing.
Okay.
And back in the day, I used to see a the Record Theater. I was still like high school or like the year after high school kind of thing. I used to go to the Record Theater all the time in Towson. That was my jam. And, you know, couldn't really like go to big concerts at, you know, went to a few, but like I couldn't just like drive across the country. I was, you know, 17 years old or whatever. And there was a Dave Matthews Band tribute. It was the DMTB was what they were called. That I saw them probably like – I probably saw them 5 or 6 times over the course of 2 summers in high school. And they were – but the guy committed. The guy like did the whole like, you know, snarly Dave Matthews like high-pitched voice thing. So you got to go all in.
Okay. All right. Okay. Any other good ones that you've seen besides the Dave Matthews tribute band?
I saw a Rush tribute band once. Like bought tickets to see it, not like just at a bar. Like saw a Rush tribute band once, and they were really good. And again, like, they were kind of more like '80s era Rush than, you know, the '70s hard rock and Rush.
Did they have just three? Was it a trio?
It was a trio. Which yeah. If you that's like a sack. If you do Rush as a quartet or more, you are blaspheming the name of Rush by doing that.
I understand, but they're such incredible musicians that your average 3 guys can't make those same sounds. So somebody might need to add somebody. Yeah, which, that's great.
Rush itself is touring without Neil Peart now. And they are adding other musicians to the fold for this tour. So you can kind of consider that a tribute band, but with the 2 original members.
Mm, okay. So when Dixie and I saw Journey, and they didn't have Steve Perry, they had the Filipino lead singer. Was that a tribute band? Is that what you said?
No, that's because you still had the other dudes, Neil Sean and Jonathan Cain. That's Journey, man.
But we didn't have Randy Jackson playing the bass.
Randy Jackson was only there for 1 album, I believe.
Yeah, I know. Dixie, do you have any tribute band experiences that are worth sharing?
I don't do tribute bands, but on screen, my favorite tribute band was the guy who say it was Step Brothers. We were strictly 80s Billy Joel, sir. Strictly 80s Billy Joel before all hell broke loose. If you want to call them a tribute band, which I don't know if we should, but the Reagan years, the 80s cover band is I've seen them at least 6 times. Last time I saw them was at the Frederick Road Fridays last June, and they're coming back this year to Catonsville on a Friday night. So if I'm around, I'll definitely check that out. But yeah, you learn something new every day, man. You paid money to go to the Meyerhof to hear a cover or a tribute band. That's interesting.
Well, it was like an Elvis performer.
I understand. All right.
Well, yeah. There's the whole, I don't know if you consider this tribute band, but there's the whole Grateful Dead like wing of bands that have sprung from them. I wouldn't consider Dead and Company, John Mayer with you know, the late Bobby Weir and the remaining members of I wouldn't consider them a tribute band, but you got Dark Star Orchestra, you got a band like J-Rad, Joe Russo's Almost Dead, that is like a more of a Dead homage. There's a whole wing of the songbook that they have and the way that they play makes for just a like you can go so many different directions in it.
So it's not a tribute band, and I don't know what iteration, because I think it's now it's Sammy Hagar, Joe Satriani, Jason Bonham, and Michael Anthony. But I have this on my playlist. It's a album called At Your Service, and it's Hagar, Bonham, Michael Anthony, and a guy named Vic Johnson, and they do a combo of Van Hagar songs as well as Led Zeppelin songs, and it's awesome. Like, it's really, really good. You get the heavy drums from Jason Bonham and just a different vocal from Sammy Hagar doing, you know, When the Levee Breaks and a Whole Lot of Love. So check that out. It's called At Your Service, Sammy Hagar. I don't know. Yeah, I guess that's the name of the tour that they were on at the time. think it's a few years old because, again, I think that Joe Satriani's now his guitarist. And but anyway, I mean, that dude's like, what, 76 years old, still kicking it?
Sammy Which Hagar? One, Satriani or say Hagar?
Sammy Hagar, yeah. And the fascinating thing, I think we've talked about this before on the show, it's been 9 years for God's sakes, but he's made more money off of the Cabo Wabo tequila than he ever did as a musician. That's crazy.
Yeah, he's a wealthy guy living a good life. Yeah, he's one of the all-timers. And that seems like a good place to stop. A reminder that the Deep Flying Dixie podcast is brought to you by Simplicity Group. Simplicity Group is a leading financial products distribution firm that specializes in providing best-in-class insurance, investment, and business development solutions. To learn more, visit simplicitygroup.com. Special thanks to this week's guest, Nick Root of Michigan, and our old buddy, Matt Kinnear. Thank you all for hanging in on our longest episode of the year. This is going to push like an hour and a half, like close to it. So if you like what you heard, please share it with a friend. It's free, and we love when you let other people know about it. You can reach us on Twitter and Instagram at DFlyingDixie. Thanks for listening. And as we get closer to the end of the season, enjoy the games.